And a lot of what I'm just going to talk about is what I'm concerned might happen. So this is my, so I'm essentially a risk manager, whether as an investment banker, an investment advisor. And this is just, you know, I'm just telling you my concerns. And it's so people can, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm not, you know, I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but what I'm telling you is this is what it looks like the game's going to, how the game's going to work to me.
Yeah.
And,
well,
and there'd be
yeah, this is a very interesting topic because obviously, well, it's related to what we're observing in Lahaina fire, but there were other fires, obviously very suspicious paradise in California, for example. And, you know, I would like to know what tricks they're playing with the real estate and stealing property and land and how it works from your experience. So that's why I wanted to schedule this interview.
Well, that's great, because I just think, I don't know how long you want to go, but I just, if I could just give you a download of everything I've been observing and thinking about. I watched a lot of patterns in the riots and the fires during the pandemic, and that was clearly a real estate steal. So now I, during 2017, and you might want to get this on tape, I had subscribed, I had a lot of subscribers in the area that was burning in Northern California. And I got hundreds of emails of very detailed explanation of what each person had experienced or someone that they knew and trusted experienced. And it was hundreds of reports. And so I was able to know for certain. It was sort of, you know, the patterns before, during, and after are all an operation. It was an operation. And Paradise was clearly an operation. And I don't know how many people they killed, but it was a lot.
Yeah. And it's, it looks very similar. I just published that note from the Geographic Information System observations.
He sent me more, and I have to go through it, and I'll get that to you too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That would be great to publish a follow-up. It's very well received. People are very interested in this information, and many have confirmed, including professional firefighters, have confirmed the suspicion that we all have that this is not a normal fire, that this is very highly managed, too precise and too selective. And also, you know, a lot of people with the same experience with Paradise and other fire, similar fires are saying the same thing.
It's way too precise. This is a redevelopment. It's, you know, they had a whole redevelopment plan and it's done with precision. Yeah.
So, yeah, so I, you sent me a couple of like a short list of tactics that were being used.
So I was going to, I made a whole long list of tactics and then I didn't have enough time to send it to you. I apologize. I said I would. But what I wanted to go through was, you know, there's a game, there's a bigger game that creates environmental conditions economically that makes it easier to steal. So I want to go through the sort of the macro, what they're up to at the macro level. Then the things they do to cut off your credit or your income. And then there are things they do to move in on you or squeeze you in a variety of ways to either get you to sell or to take.
Yeah.
And it's very complicated. And if you look at the different lines, you've got the who, you've got the media, you've got the banks, but then you have local, you know, federal, state, and local regulatory structures that may also be engaged. You know, it changes jurisdiction to jurisdiction. We've seen, I observed some of the patterns during the pandemic on the riots. We can talk about that. The way I saw a lot was reverse engineering. I was in HUD cleaning up the fraud. And by looking at the different deals that you were cleaning up or dealing with, it took many years, but I learned, okay, what created it on the front end. And the amount of money that was being pulled out of dirty real estate deals was just unbelievable. And it had complete official sanction. You know, this, it was approved top down. Otherwise it was way too complicated to just get away with as a fraudster. So.
Yeah. That's so, clearly.
Well, here's another thing to understand. It's important to understand that one of the biggest sources of political contributions is capital gains. And it's capital gains on securities, but it's capital gains on the real estate. So you do something, government does something that, let's say it gives a contract to a company, its stock goes up, some of the contributions roll back through the law firm or the lobbyists or the company to the politician. And so you're constantly trying to make things go up that generate capital gains that, you know, and there's this cycle, this unvirtuous cycle between the investors who want capital gains and the politicians who want political donations and government doing things that generate that increase. So during the pandemic, by shutting down Main Street, you shift enormous amounts of market share into the publicly traded companies and their stock goes up and then, you know, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this, all I can tell you is understanding the typical financial patterns around the real estate or the companies helps you understand what's going on. When you look at a scene and it looks totally incoherent, when you map out the money, you're like, no, you know, it's not incoherent at all. Everybody's just making money.
Yeah.
You can see it. Anyway, okay. Well, let's dive in and you tell me how you want to do this.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about maybe, you know, what you see from the pattern. Yeah, and we can do either with, you know, COVID riots or more specifically like this Lahaina fire. Can you explain to people like how this fraud, this stealing of land and property, how does it work in general?
Okay. So I first learned about it growing up in a poor neighborhood, and I saw the mortgage fraud and sort of scam deals on foreclosures and, you know, low-income housing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was done around the Federal Housing Administration and HUD. So I first watched it in my neighborhood, and it was one of the things that inspired me to understand why people thought they could make more money wrecking a neighborhood than they could making a neighborhood wonderful. I thought that was very strange. And anyway, but, you know, long story short, I went to Wall Street. And one of the reasons I went to Wall Street is I went to a firm where you could go through all the different markets because I was trying to understand how the money worked in a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And what it took me years to understand was you can't understand how the money works in one neighborhood anywhere on the planet without understanding the global financial markets.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to go through all the money to come back to my little neighborhood in West Philadelphia. But and a lot of the fraud in the federal government that was financing the black budget was mortgage and real estate fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at real estate from the point of view of databases, the Fed and the federal government had incredible databases. Because the credit is so subsidized by the federal credit, there's incredible centralization of surveillance and data on real estate and places.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, real estate is one of the big sources of capital gains and sort of wealth. So then I went to become, I served as Assistant Secretary of Housing. And what I discovered was a lot of the housing programs that had been developed in the 60s and 70s, supposedly to end poverty and help low-income neighborhoods, you know, they were not. They were redevelopment gigs where developers made a lot of money, and you saw these hundreds of different games of developers coming in, making money, the media persuading everybody that using all this taxpayers' money was wonderful to help poor people, you know, so they would support it. And then the bankers were there to control a lot of what was going on, even though it looked like government.
Mm-hmm.
They would control the servicing, they would control the back end in many different ways. And so you had this pincer movement of the developers, of the media and the banks, and the official narrative was always very different than sort of the game of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And one way you learned was to sort of map out who wins, who loses, you know, how does this go on? So
mm-hmm.
I cleaned up a lot of financial fraud at HUD, and then my company became the lead financial advisor to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And that forced me, I was able using relational database technology to put together fantastic databases, both on all the housing money in the country, but look at it by neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I could take the accounting from different agencies, and instead of looking at by function, I could do relational databases that showed me in a neighborhood how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was finding was, you'd find this neighborhood where there were, you could buy and rehab a foreclosed property in the single family FHA portfolio for $50,000. But HUD was spending $250,000 to do public housing in the same 4-block area. And a very famous story, I took, you know, we did GIS software mapping in all these different cities and we're proving, look, we could get 5 homes for the price of one. And I took it to the woman who was the assistant to the guy who ran the public housing program. And she said, but how would we generate fees for our friends?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. You know, anyway, so in the process of doing those two assignments, I discovered a huge amount about all the different economic warfare games of making money on real estate, you know, other than a legitimate, I mean, there are many, many wonderful legitimate real estate people, but there's also this huge game of trying to buy it for much less than it's worth by mm-hmm. doing, you know, playing games that drive the price down or buying it and getting government to do something that'll drive the price up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it could be, you know, and part of it's a private game and part of it's a public game. Often it works together.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell people it's like the Joy of Cooking book. There's hundreds of recipes, but it all fundamentally comes down to picking it up cheap, you know, or selling it above market and getting the government to do all sorts of things that, you know, once you pick it up cheap, gets it to go up in value.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, political contributions roll off the end. And I have an online book called Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, where I show you how the game between the government doing various things to generate capital gains.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the case study I use is private prisons. But in fact, that was a big real estate play
mm-hmm.
because you want to move into a neighborhood. You want to clean the people out. You know, you can burn them out. You can force them out. You can buy them out, but you can also move them to prison. There are many different ways of doing it. You can bring in drugs and kill them,
uh-huh.
you know, but you want to get the people out and you want to get the land cheap.
Right.
So the private prison was part of a real estate play in certain neighborhoods. Anyway, so when I thought of you immediately when this happened. James Rogowski got me to read the IHR amendments and mm-hmm. he called me and he said, look, you have to understand this is much bigger than health.
Mm-hmm.
So I read the amendments and I read the treaties. I read about 1,000 pages, not everything, but about 1,000 pages that he had selected out for me. And that's what I thought of you immediately because I started to laugh. And I just said, this is a real estate steal.
Mm-hmm.
This is, if I had to put together an infrastructure that will allow me to control the politics in any community in America, and then steal various assets, including the real estate, I could not have put together a more elegant machinery. I was in awe. I was like, the fraudsters have taken it to a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
So here's what I saw. What I saw was an infrastructure that's being built that will allow a SWAT, what I would call a SWAT team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there's a difference between what the WHO does and then what these national offices they're getting set up in the sort of jurisdictional lines. So there's a, you know, there's a national and local team that's working through the country, but then you have the WHO. So, you know, this mechanism will allow them to drop in a team of experts in an emergency
mm-hmm.
because they can do surveillance on the whole planet. I mean, they can surveil down to the sewer in your neighborhood or your house globally, if I understand it correctly. And they can say, ah, Sasha,
mm-hmm.
you have an invisible pathogen in your sewer system.
Uh-huh.
We have to quarantine and lock down your whole neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is an invisible enemy and they have all these big experts.
Yeah.
How are you used to say, wait a minute, you know, I did tests. You know, I have all this fancy equipment, which you don't have. And there's no invisible pathogen in my, you know, yeah. Now, I would point out they're also indirectly connected to a huge biolab network. So if they want to put one in, just in case you do have experts, they can do that too.
Mm-hmm.
But so they can do total surveillance. They can claim that there is a reason to quarantine, condemn, you know, buildings or places in a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this means is if I've got a bunch of rebel rousers in a neighborhood, I've got a SWAT team that can go and shut them down. And the beauty of my SWAT team is I'm going to have a media. So there's the healthcare, there's the media, there's the banking. I'm going to have a media that is going to explain to all the other neighborhoods, even if everybody in my community knows it's total yaya. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to put out on the media, oh, there's Ebola in Sasha's toilet and you can't go into her neighborhood because you will die and you will get Ebola too. And so everybody says, oh, well, I call it the story of good. I don't have to intercede because they're there to help Sasha. Mm-hmm. You know, they're good. You know, so that gives, they're afraid, and that gives them their excuse to believe that they're a good person and they can stay on the couch. You know, mm-hmm. there's 1,000 stories that we give everybody as to why it's safe for them to stay on the couch.
Right.
And so how are you or your community or your mayor or your city council supposed to come up with an equivalent team of experts who can defeat them, let alone get the story out, because you got to go around the media?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if I can go into a neighborhood and I can quarantine for a long period of time, what I can do is a lot of businesses get forced into bankruptcy or lose massive income. A lot of people can lose their jobs and put them in a position where they're forced to sell the assets to, you know, to basically recapitalize and going.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing I do, I devastate a lot of incomes.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I do is I can condemn, you know, something, you know, if it's bad enough, it takes 2 years to remediate the invisible weapon or, you know, the magic virus, you know, then theoretically I can condemn and move in and take over and, you know, do whatever. And we end up now, once you get control of the land, the next thing you do is you say, ah, we need to help the people in Sasha's neighborhood. This has been terrible for them. We're going to authorize big government contracts to help rebuild the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys who picked that land up cheap now get government money to take it back up. So mm-hmm. they not only get it cheap, but now they have massive benefits to, you know, take it back up.
Yeah, so that's what the person who wrote about the GIS said, that, you know, they burned the poor neighborhoods very precisely, and then there is a designated area where they're supposed to rebuild this, you know, perfect 15-minute city, right?
Right.
To move them all into it.
Well, it's quite remarkable because you saw this in California, you know, you have these homes that are devastated. And then you come up and there's infrastructure that's totally untouched. And then there's some big hotel mm-hmm. and it's absolutely touched. And then you go on and there's a, you know, it's all burned down. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the drone shot I think it was the drone shot you published with the description of GIS, you know, you see that this is a GIS designed burn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a clearing. And what I have to tell you is, if you were going to have to buy that land or do it with eminent domain or do it through the local zoning and ordinance and planning and city council process, it would take you a decade or two to accumulate that land or get any of this done.
Mm-hmm.
So you not only speed up the process enormously, you skyrocket your return on investment, because your initial investment is so low and the redevelopment can go so fast.
Yes, yeah.
So if you look at these things as sort of a leverage buyout on a neighborhood, I used mm-hmm. to write a lot about leverage buyouts of a neighborhood, but if you look at what it does to the economics of the leverage it's phenomenal mm-hmm. because you so lower your money in. And then you the speed is everything. You can really speed up, and then you've got everything cleared at the same time. It's just go. So now we see that, because it's not just fire that does these things. If you look at what happened in Katrina,
mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people I met from New Orleans when I went the next time after Katrina who said, yeah, they blew the levees. And I think it was 77 or 78, and they blew the levees this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's done with fire. It's done with, you know, with water. So with flooding, you know, we saw it done during the pandemic with with riots.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll tell you the story of what happened, because we have a wonderful guy on our team who does GIS software, which I love. I think it's such a great way to look at data contiguous to living systems.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at a financial ecosystem contiguous with a living ecosystem, and that's what makes it powerful. Anyway, but we were watching something going, what was going on in Minneapolis was strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching the patterns of where the riots were, and I was saying, something's wrong. Something's wrong. So I got my teammate. I said, make me a list of every major city in the United States. So we do a row for every city. And then I want to see what political party the mayor is.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see what the population is. And then I want you to tell me if there is a Federal Reserve bank, you know, so there are 12 banks, but then there are many offices and there's some smaller sub offices. I think it's a total of 37, including the headquarters. Said, I want you to designate whether there's a Fed location or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because clearly part of what they're trying to do is get the smart grid infrastructure in.
Yeah.
And you certainly needed major pipes going into the Fed installations. So I said, put the Fed office, and then I want to see where the riot occurs within an opportunity zone.
Mm-hmm.
So he lays this all out. And I think of 37 Fed locations, they had riots in 34. I said, now that is a remarkable coincidence. So then we took the first one, which was Minneapolis, because some wonderful activist in Minneapolis put up a list of all the buildings that had been burned with their addresses. So what we discovered, because I've been looking into opportunity zones. Do you know what an opportunity zone is?
No, a little bit, but maybe you can describe it. Sorry.
So an opportunity zone was a tax mechanism created in 2018 that said if you invest in an opportunity zone and you do if and it gets complicated, you know, over a certain period, you can avoid paying capital gains on your taxes. So if you're Jeff Bezos, you have a zero basis on your Amazon stock. Coming into the pandemic at the high, you sell $4 billion of Amazon stock. If you invest that $4 billion in building smart grids and opportunity zones, you can avoid paying an enormous amount of capital gains, right? Okay, and you know, the reports were it was a lot of the tech people who'd made a lot of money in tech who wanted this opportunity. And clearly, if you're going to build out the smart grid, then, you know, I should call it the stupid grid. If you're going to build out the control grid infrastructure, you know, using opportunities is a great way to move your money out of tech, get away from the danger of a low basis, put it into the opportunity zone. Okay, so I said, okay, so let's map out Minneapolis and show me where the Minneapolis Fed is and show me where the opportunities are. Well, at the base of this opportunity zone, sort of across and down from the Fed, there's a line at the bottom that goes all across Lake Boulevard. It's just, I don't know Minneapolis well, but it's like this. And if you look at the properties, it supposedly it was a sort of, you know, was rising up from a low income, but there's a lot of small business and minority owners. It's just like a burn right across the bottom of the opportunity zone. And it's contiguous with the opportunity zone. And if you look at, you know, real life is organic. It doesn't look like that. And we just, once he mapped it out on the GIS software, I said, oh my God, this is, you know, these are all redevelopments. This is just a redevelopment plan. And my understanding was after they burned everybody out, apparently the city demanded all sorts of expenditures to bring your property into safety, blah, 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 blah. You know, and of course that's forcing sales. That's one of the things you do. You have the local jurisdiction, you know, or different jurisdictions move in and start to demand, okay, now that we've cut your income and bankrupted your business, we're going to demand all sorts of, you know, that you invest all sorts of money in fixing up this and doing this. And of course you can't, you have to sell. Another thing that goes on is they pull the insurance. Sometimes they pull it right before they start the fires. So, you know, and it's different in different places, but if you suddenly see a lot of property insurance getting canceled in place, you know, that's the time to, you know, make sure you are properly insured and hedge your bets and be careful. So anyway, so I told you one of my favorite TV series, it's been twice, it's been movie of the year on the Salary Report, is Yellowstone. And it's the story of a rancher in Montana. And I've spent a couple years off and on living in Montana. And of course, it's very beautiful. But what you learn by listening to Yellowstone is it's just season after season of dirty tricks and economic disaster capitalism trying to steal everybody's land. It's all land wars, you know, and the land was stolen of the Indians, and Indians are trying to keep everybody from stealing more. And then now they're stealing from the ranchers. And now the Indians and the ranchers are teaming up because now, you know, now instead of being in a different boat, they're in the same boat. It gets very funny. And you get the activists coming in and all the different, one of the great things about Yellowstone, you see the media game. You see how the, you know, you've got regulators and courts moving in on you for a variety of ways. You've got the political process moving in on you. You've got the sort of private guys moving in, sometimes using private suits or doing things to the property, like to go upstream and cut off your water by blocking the river. And, you know, it's just endless, and it's coming. It's a very immersive game, and it comes at you from many different directions. And I think one of the reasons Yellowstone is so popular is it shows people how the game works. They're like, ah, okay, now I can get in the game because now I see how the game works. And of course, they do some economic poisoning your cattle, and you know they do some economic warfare, but it doesn't begin to get as dirty as, of course, we've seen in Paradise or, you know, some of these fires. So I wanted to mention another thing, because we talked a little bit about what it feels like on the ground. There's a huge environmental condition that's going to happen before the WHO amendments are hopefully never approved, but before they try. So before the WHO game may roll down on us, we have a couple of environmental conditions that is going to make the WHO game even more powerful. And that is, you have the Fed taking up interest rates tremendously. And so now if your property's harmed and you need to refinance it, the cost of capital to you is dramatically higher. That won't be necessarily true of the people coming at you. You know, so think of this as a war. So the team coming at you, you know, the Fed injected $5 trillion during the pandemic. So a lot of them are sitting on huge cash stockpiles, right? And they're also drawing money from corporations and government. So you've got a distinct cost of capital disadvantage. But the other thing is, the Fed, in my opinion, and we've done a lot of this on the Salary Report, is trying to consolidate the banking system in a very aggressive and dramatic way. And if they achieve that, they will not only be able to raise the cost of capital, but cut off your access to capital. And so if you look at, you know, you're up against an opponent who's got a very low cost of capital and tremendous access to capital, and you've got a very high cost of capital and your access is being shut off. So I remember when I litigated with the Department of Justice, where I learned a lot about how this works, literally one day I'm very wealthy and my income is significantly greater than my personal or business expenses. And the next day I have no income. I'm choking on my overhead. My credit is cut off and they're trying to cut off all my, you know, assets and sources of money. And the speed at which you can flip in a situation like this is, is not only dramatic, but it's planned. Yeah. So, right. And that's why I'm glad we had the opportunity to do this, because we want to talk through all the different kind of games and risk issues so people can start thinking this way. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit more about the local area that you're in. Mm-hmm. The most important thing I think you can do is make sure you understand the nature of the jurisdiction you're in, because jurisdiction matters. It matters where you are, and it matters what your relationships are, because when trouble comes, it's not the time to begin relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have great relationships with the local sheriff and you have a good constitutional sheriff and you have good relationships with your bank and with your city council and your neighbors, you know, it's very useful when this comes To be in a place where you don't know anybody and, you know, nobody's there to help you, because you get in these situations where you really need to watch each other's back. So who the local sheriff is and who the local police are very important. Right. And one of the most important questions is, do they have control files? Okay. So do you know what I mean by control files?
Yeah.
Okay. Because if they have control files, they're going to do whatever they're told.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And so that, unfortunately, that's like the, you know, a lot of areas in the cities, especially, you know, like San Francisco, good luck. I think that that's what they're doing right now. It's destroying it. And, you know, I don't know what they're going to pull, but at the moment they got rid, you know, they got rid of the even big businesses downtown. Shopping malls are leaving, hotels are leaving, closing. The city is a disaster. Emergency response is 45 minutes and rising. It's completely awful.
It's a plan.
It's a plan.
That's a Lahaina is a fast plan. The San Francisco is the more civilized slow plan.
Yeah, so
but
slow
it's
plan.
The same plan, right?
But I'm just waiting, almost like you've described. You know, you see things going downhill so fast, and obviously on purpose. But for example, you know, like a couple of years ago, they made it essentially okay to steal up to $950 worth of merchandise. So, and that over, you know, 18 months or so resulted in closure of all the, you know, luxury stores. The Union Square used to be fantastic and beautiful shopping place,
right?
Restaurants, tourism, and now it's a disaster zone. They shuttered. They had some of the like luxury stores stayed open with armed guards in front, but I think it's even that is over now. So I'm just waiting. What are they going to do? They're going to generate earthquake with their weapons or a fire? You know, those tend to be traditions in San Francisco.
Right. I have no idea what they're going to do. I'm assuming they're building up to clearing everything for some reason. And, you know, the
reason
question
is it's
is,
such a fantastic real estate, that area. It's, I think that's the reason. I think that's why it's so attractive and it's so valuable.
I'm assuming they're looking to do a major aggregation and do some kind of reinvention. I mean, that takes that kind of clearing. You know, the only other thing in theory, and because I like to think of every possible scenario, it is theoretically possible they know about some geophysical risk and they don't want to tell people what it is, but they need to get them out of there. So in theory, there could be, we could write a movie where they're doing, you know, they're doing a good thing. And where, you know, I always say, let's just pretend I was in charge and I wanted to do the best thing for the people. And this is what I would do. What's the plot?
Well, but, you know, I don't think it's possible to do a good thing with lies. And they're clearly lying. So,
I think they're clearing. I think they have major, major move-in plans. And, you know, we can speculate on what they are, but that's the most logical explanation.
So, I think I also noticed that, for example, so, you know, because I do, I have a property in the greater Bay Area, I would say, not in San Francisco. But I've noticed that while they're essentially terrorizing and demolishing San Francisco itself and Oakland, you know, those cities, they are also rapidly, rapidly building outside, just a bit outside, like Napa City, City of Napa, which is right on the north of San Pablo Bay. They're huge construction projects, and they're kind of like, you know, they look like 15-minute cities. They look like these tightly controlled neighborhoods with, you know, not high rises, but condos, like 3-4-story condos, apartments. Right. And but they're also like you could see how they're planned in very controlled way, and there are numerous of them. And I was like, well, what are they building for? Like, it's such a growing, like, it's not a big town. It was maybe 30,000, 40,000
workforce.
So I think what's going on, they're gonna do something in the city so that, and then say, oh, here are these subsidized places for you to move, like right outside,
right.
And that's what they're. I think that's kind of the plan.
Well, but the other thing is they have tremendous demand for, you know, to do Silicon Valley 2 up north.
Yeah.
They were bursting at the seams in Silicon Valley, and they need to do a whole new Silicon 2, Silicon 3. And if you go up to where Santa Rosa and where the fires were, and then across to, you know, the line through Sacramento over to Tahoe, you know, mm-hmm. they're going to build that up and out. And it wouldn't surprise me to see another Silicon Valley 2, Silicon Valley 3.
Actually, yeah, there is one. The Andreessen and LinkedIn founder and a whole bunch of Silicon Valley guys just bought 50,000 acres.
Right.
Solano County, which is around Travis Air Force. It's like a long highway. Right. And they're planning to build some kind of a model, another model city.
Right.
You know, another socialist paradise. And you're right, there's also a lot of developments, new developments, again, looking like these 15-minute city-controlled neighborhoods all across Highway 80. I drive on it often, and I see it going up.
Right.
And again, who is moving in?
Well, you know, if you look at what they want to move back from Asia,
uh-huh.
You know, there's a lot they want to move back in, is what I suspect.
Yeah.
And my guess is if you look at the housing that they're putting in, it's a significantly lower per square foot per person mm-hmm. than what was in California 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Right. So if you look at the value of homes on average in America since World War II, a lot of the increase was just two things. It was inflation and making the square footage bigger.
Yeah.
And now they're going to take the square footage back and significantly lower the housing ownership is what they're, you know, sort of what the vision is. So, but one of the things that has happened, and, you know, I talk a lot at Solari about what I call the breakaway civilization. Mm-hmm. So there was a moment when I was working with the cabinet secretary, he got very angry at one of the people in the room, and it was a regional director from California. He said, "Mr. Secretary, I had to do it. It's the law." And the secretary just exploded. He said, the law, I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority." And what he was really referring to was the shadow, you know, he was talking about the shadow government. He had permission to do what he was doing, and he could ignore the law on that thing because, you know, the breakaways at this point were above the law. Mm-hmm. And what has happened is you've had this bifurcation in our society where one group stays in the legacy economy, and they basically shift the majority of the money. They steal it by criminal means, but they shift it over into this economy. This economy is very high tech, has a very high learning speed, and has developed incredible invisible weaponry, invisible surveillance, invisible mind control, all this sort of high tech stuff. They're going at lightning speed, and they're keeping it secret from these people.
Mm-hmm.
And now what is happening is these people are breaking back in. And I assure you, they have no patience for 20 years in the redevelopment process. They're just going to burn the place down and take it, mm-hmm. you know, because they can. And part of it is because if you look at all of us in the legacy economy, we can't fathom that this parallel, you know, world has grown up and doesn't have to obey our laws and doesn't have to pay attention to us and really doesn't need us. And they're just going to do what they're going to do. They're not going to explain anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's happening for a variety of reasons. But the question for all of us is, given their invisible weaponry and given their immunity from the law in most cases, not all cases, what are we going to do?
Yeah, that was my next question, you know.
Right.
I personally, you know, sort of on the invisible weaponry, yes, they do have invisible weaponry, but I'm not sure about those energy weapons that were used, lasers or microwaves or whatever, you know, there are different descriptions that exist.
Right. So I've looked into all, theoretically, all the different kind of weaponry that can do that. And I've given up trying to figure out how they're doing it. Mm-hmm. I know they're doing it, but I don't know which one or how.
Right. The I've also looked into it, and it appears that at least in case of Lahaina and Paradise, it was what's called microwave because of the pattern that is like burning from inside out versus right. Laser would be outside in. Now, Okay, so they have that. I mean, other types of invisible weapons, people freak out about viruses and stuff. I freak out much less about that because I know more about it. and that's largely just them lying. I mean, and they're sometimes right. just so tired of coming up with new BS variant. Like somebody said, the best, you know, new variant is going to be BS 24/7.
I have to write that down. You know, my vision of the next emergency excuse, I call it Putin 19. You know, it's biowarfare, and Putin, the Russians have, you know, injected this bioweapon into the...
I know.
I like BS 24/7.
I like the BS 24/7 variant. So anyway, but that is, you know, from my point of view, from my expertise, is easier to counter than, you know, the other types. And I'm somewhat also familiar with what can be done with lasers, and that it is actually quite scary.
Right.
But that's my question. You know, how can people, my number one priority right now is to make everyone aware of this,
right.
because while, you know, to some extent we made progress on the COVID front and people started realizing that, okay, they're lying, the lying about the masks and stuff. People are, again, like, once you start publishing materials on this, they're like, oh, you're accusing them of mass murder. It's very serious. And I'm like, well, we already have proven that they've mass murdered people.
So here's the thing. In fiscal 1995, there was a breakdown. So I've described this before, but there was a breakdown in the ability of the establishment to achieve a balanced budget. And then a process began where trillions of dollars started disappearing from the federal accounts. I call it a financial coup d'etat, because I think they gave up. And that's what I was told. The largest pension fund in the country, CalPERS, California System, told me they have given up on the country. They're moving all the money out. And I thought he meant they're moving all the money they can move legally. And what I realized when I discovered how much was going missing from the federal government is no. They're levering, you know, they're issuing huge amounts of treasury bonds, and then they're taking the money and they're going. Now, I'm grossly oversimplifying. We have a website called missingmoney.solaria.com, and you can spend a lifetime learning all about it. And there's tremendous amount of documentation with their financial statements. So this is coming. This is their stuff. But I think they gave up on trying to run the federal credit mechanism on a balanced budget basis. They just gave up. Because the only way they could manage the political process was to buy everybody off. And so everybody, you know, let's just keep giving away more free money. Anyway, so the only way you could then balance the budget was to lower life expectancy. And so every year I would talk about the missing money and try and encourage people to look at the missing money. Because I said, if we don't fix this, their only solution is to bring down life expectancy. That is the only solution. They have to do it. And you know, so it's an average game. You don't need everybody to die, but you need to lower the life expectancy in the general population to match up. And the more you are in trouble on your pension or healthcare or other social obligation liabilities, and the more your subsidy from abroad, from globalization, diminishes because the BRICS decide to, you know, organize and ditch you. So the more people leave your channel, the less subsidy you have to pay everybody off on, and the more you've got a lower life expectancy or lower financial footprint or expectations. And so when because if you look at the fires in California, either that had to be done by DOD and its contractors, or they had to let it happen because they control the airspace. I mean, we spend $800+ billion a year, you know, overtly on a military that controls everything. How can it, you know, so the same guys who are missing $20 trillion from their financial statements over the last 20 years just happen to be the guys who are depopulating the country. I mean, that is not a coincidence, right? I mean, can we look at that together?
Exactly. And the life expectancy, that's a very interesting number. Obviously, it's for them, it's all numbers game.
Right.
In fact, it's what was that Nazi leader who was called Eichmann, Adolf Eichmann. Anyway, he was like
I think it's Goebbels. You were
No, not the Goebbels, but the guy who was like Fauci of Hitler's Fauci. He was health, public health, and by public health they meant, you know, sending people to their death in death camps. And he was in hiding for a long time, as far as I remember. And then finally, when he was caught, he was like, I was just doing my job. It was all, it was a numbers job. We just, right. You know, it was just statistics and public health numbers that we were doing. And that's right. The number that they're concerned with is life expectancy. And it happens to be highly affected, not by the average lifespan necessarily, but by childhood mortality, number one, right. Childhood mortality.
Right.
That's why they're so after pregnant women and children, right. And babies, and catching them in the hospital right away and giving them all kinds of poisonous injections right away, including now approved monoclonal antibody, which is,
right.
I mean, it's as evil as it gets.
Right. Now, notice as you are bringing down life expectancy. So my understanding is during the pandemic years, I think life expectancy dropped 3 years.
A huge number. Right. Yeah. It went down right. to, I think it went down to, it's approaching, you know, now kind of third world levels. It went down to about 72, 73 in the US from 80. Like it dropped. If you're looking at the last years, I mean, right. Average is still probably not so bad, but it significant.
Right. And to the extent I've seen the numbers, this is very scripted state by state. My guess is different states and different countries have quota systems,
mm-hmm.
and it's all done, you know, they're all driving to the numbers. And this is just like the Maui redevelopment plan was very sophisticated in terms of software and analytics. So is this. And basically what they're trying to do is simply bring down life expectancy on a basis where, one, it doesn't look like a kill,
mm-hmm.
because what you're trying to do, I call it the great poisoning. And I started calling it the great poisoning many years ago, because what you're trying to do is increase toxicity and lower general health, or some people would call immune system, mm-hmm. in a way that everybody dies of their weakness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's more noticeable when young people get the injection and get myocarditis, but a lot of the deaths are, you know, they're hard to identify as directly coming from the injection, because you suddenly get fast acting cancer, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have a stroke. Well, he was 60, you know,
uh-huh.
and so you want to make it look very organic, and you want everybody to die of their weakness. Not, you know, it's not like we all got the measles and died.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, and then of course they're huge disability numbers, and you want to do it in a way that it lowers my mental capacity to fight you on what you're up to,
mm-hmm.
to see it and to fight you. So when I was litigating with the Department of Justice, I was poisoned 8 times. And then I went through a very significant detox. And what was amazing is, if you look at what happened to my mental acuity as I got poisoned, because my heavy metals just skyrocketed. And then I detoxed and they came way, way down. And so I experienced the loss of mental acuity, and then I regained much of it. And so I realized at the peak of the toxicity, you know, it's very hard for you to be a good navigator or a good risk manager, because you're so, you know, it's like being completely, I don't know how to describe it. It's not quite like being stoned, but it's, you know, you're just, you yeah. can't think. You just don't have the brain power.
Yeah.
You're not quick.
Yeah. People, especially people who got injections, and maybe even they don't have much of the adverse events, but I've noticed, you know, people aging extremely rapidly. Like,
right.
Where I've seen that person, you know, before they got injected, maybe like 2 years ago, and they looked, you know, their age, 40, 45.
Yeah, I've seen people who in 1 year go age 10 years.
Yes. Yeah. Like they look 10 years older, 20 years older. And this is, I'm not just me not saying, talk to other colleagues. And that just demonstrates that the person is not well, and maybe they're not, they don't have any specific, anything specific going on, but they are not thinking straight anymore. And that's a big problem. But I guess I wanted to come back, like what people can do.
Right. So when I was a kid, the African-American communities would call what we're talking about the beatdown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they come at you on health, they come at you on media, they come the banks, they come, you know, it comes in all the different areas and it's called the beatdown. The first thing you need to do is, so jurisdiction matters. There are jurisdictions where this is more likely to happen than not. But there are also jurisdictions where you do have constitutional sheriffs and you do have good police and you do have state legislators and leadership that really wants that not to go on in their place. And they're hip to this. So one of the reasons I stayed in Tennessee was because we had a lot of leadership that didn't want these kind of things going on in the place. And if you look at the history of Tennessee, they don't let the little stuff get going. It's very interesting. So I was an investment advisor for 10 years. And when I went through the process, you know, they were extremely difficult. Whereas in the states where you get a lot of fraud, they're real easy. You know, Tennessee, they'll just torture you because they want to make sure, you know, we don't cotton to that stuff here. Anyway, so you want to be in a good, relatively good jurisdiction. You want to know your sheriff, you want to know your neighbors, and you want to find the people in the area who understand these games and are prepared to help each other, you know, be more resilient and help each other if this comes. Now, there are also things that happen before an operation like Lahaina or Paradise that will tell you something's up. And one of the reasons to be networked with your neighbors and watching is if you're in a place like Lahaina, you know, for the last couple of years, billionaires have been moving into Maui like there's no tomorrow, and Hawaii. It's not just Maui. And you know the billionaires are moving in and lots of people are trying to buy land. And so you know there's a lot of powerful forces who want your land. If you're going to control that island, you know, my understanding is a lot of the ships come in into that port. So part of it is you want the, you know, it's a no-brainer that the guys who are buying the big land on the island are going to want to control the port. Mm-hmm. And so you need to find a way, you know, it's much better if you can to find a way to get along with the people moving in and find a way to communicate and get them to get enough of their way. So it's not, you know, they don't have to come in and burn. But if you see those things going on, you know, in some cases you may just need to get out or you need to be prepared to get out quickly if it happens. So one of the things, I know this sounds petty, but one of the things I constantly tell everybody, we have a great article on archiving at Solari. Just come to Solari and put in archive. I said, you want to have proper insurance on everything and you want to have copies of all your documents, your land title, your, you know, all your property documents and your insurance. You want to have great insurance and you want to have 10 copies all over the world, not just where you are. Because the guys, you know, for after Katrina, the guys who came back quickly were the guys who had, they had their documents, they had their paper. And, you know, they put their money in, they got their insurance money right away. You also want to make sure you're insured up to the hilt. One of the things I've tried to do is get, when I was still an investment advisor, is to get my clients to get safes that could withstand. Most fireproof safes can withstand 1,200 and may not be able to withstand these kind of fires is what I'm told by the fire department. And so whether it's archiving or your precious metals or other valuables, you want to have a strategy where whatever you keep at home is going to survive this kind of fire. And that means more floor safes and other, you know, but that's something for a neighborhood to get the proper kind of people in and figure out, okay, how you're going to do it. One of the reasons people are pressing their states to get bullion depositories is they want to be able to protect this stuff and hold it under state power. And, you know, a state can have a militia or, you know, the kind of enforcement. So I think one, educating yourself about it, getting sophisticated with your neighbors. And I'll tell you what I did, and I'm not necessarily recommending this, But I knew when I settled the litigation, I got a lot of money back in. And instead of buying a big house in a nice neighborhood, I bought the tiniest country home in what I considered to be the least desirable neighborhood for any billionaire in America, the last place they would ever want to come. Because I said, I want to be in the least socially desirable, least socially prestigious, least, you know, I would never have bought a house in Maui because I said, you know, I don't want to have a pissing contest with these guys ever again. So I've got better, now I have better things to do with my time. One of the reasons I live in the Netherlands now is the physical harassment had started because there were some developers who got interested. And sure enough, the physical, you know, they send in the drug gangs. It looks like random crime, but it's not. It's pushing you out. And I just said, I'd gone to Paris to see the Da Vinci exhibit in Paris. I love Leonardo da Vinci. And we had the year of Da Vinci. So we're traipsing all around to the Da Vinci exhibits. I come back. The physical harassment started again. And I said, you know something? I'm just tired of playing Tomb Raider. Uh-huh. You know, my Tomb Raider phase is over. So I'm going to get an apartment in the Netherlands, get residency, and I'll come back and forth. But I'm just, you know, and the way I dealt with the physical harassment during the litigation was I lived in four places on an unpredictable schedule, uh-huh. You know, and it just was my way of dealing with it. But, you know, of course, my other way of dealing with it was to have guns. One of the things I will tell everybody here, if you are not trained and armed, you need to get it. And if there is one thing you better fight and die for at the state house in your state, it is the Second Amendment and the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. Second Amendment are standing between us and the abyss and a well-armed population. One of the reasons they haven't been able to do the kind of real estate steal they've wanted, they can't get rid of the Second Amendment. And if you look at the times that Congress or a state has protected a state, the Second Amendment, you know, the guys doing the protection are totally clear. This is not about, you know, this is not about guns. Mm-hmm. This is about real estate. This is about our assets. You know, they know.
Right. It's about our wealth, our family, our everything. Right. That's how we protect ourselves.
Right. The other thing I would say, and this is very important to your attitude. So we have a program at Solaria called Building Wealth. You know, the problem with what is happening is these guys are stealing wealth. Mm-hmm. We have to be about building wealth. Now that includes protecting your wealth, and that's, you know, and protecting your wealth these days requires this kind of discussion and this kind of organization. And that's why you want to be in a jurisdiction with like-minded people who know how to fight. And I want to tell you before we close, I want to tell you one story about the swine flu, but you need to have in your mind that you're a wealth builder and you need to build wealth and you need to not let the beat down persuade you that, oh, I just want to survive. No, you know, as soon as you let go of your wealth in your mind, they've won. Don't. Yeah. So this is about wealth. And the honest folks can create a lot more wealth than the guy stealing the wealth can, you know, which is why they steal our wealth.
That's why they're stealing. That's why they're desperate.
So I want to tell you one story because this was so much fun. When the swine flu pandemic got tried, I was convinced they were going to try what they succeeded with in COVID. And so there was a group of people very early who jumped on, and very early I wrote an article saying, you know, I'm a former assistant secretary of housing and these guys are trying to engineer a genocide, you know, and I took it back to the missing money. I got laughed at, you know, the derision was, you know what the derision is like, because you deal with it every day anyway. But so we were just pounding and pounding and pounding, and they got the vaccine mandated in Massachusetts. And then we went full bore. There was Gary Noel was one of them. He was awesome. He was suing. And I mean, it was incredible. It was a war. And we succeeded, but right before we succeeded, I called Franklin Sanders. Franklin and his seven kids have this huge compound. You have to drive through three streams to get there. I mean, it's way out in rural Tennessee. And of course, they're all well-armed. I called Franklin and I said, Franklin, I don't think they're going to be able to mandate this in Tennessee, but if they do, I'm not taking it. He said, no, none of us are taking it either. And I said, well, if they do mandate it, I'd like to have a plan for the worst case, you know, even if it's a small case, so I don't worry about it. I said, can I bring my guns and come over to your house? Because if they try and give me this injection, you know, there's going to be a gunfight. And I would rather be over at your house having a gunfight with you than alone. He said, oh, you get in the car and you come over here because we're going to have a big old gunfight. And I truly believe it was literally the next week they shut it down. I think they heard hundreds of thousands of those. I think the NSA just heard every gun owner in America talk about how they were being prepared to go to war.
Absolutely. And they heard it because they scraped, and, you know, especially now when we're talking, they're scraping this information as we speak. And that's why it's, I've written about this. That's why I wrote, actually you started me thinking about that and took me several months to write about mind control.
Right.
And so it comes down to mind control is it's largely linguistic, and actually you win or lose largely in your head first, and in your verbalization. Okay. Right. So you have to speak about this very openly, because by speaking it, not only we get aligned and we get good ideas going and ourselves in the space of truth, we also let them know that we know.
Right.
And once that circulates, they have to retreat. They get backed into a situation where they can't lie anymore.
Right. So the little secret here is, if you look at the operations that are doing all of these things, they're highly dependent on millions of us who are going to work and helping them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the more we bring transparency, for example, to what happened to Lee, you know, or these kinds of situations, the more all the people down the supply chain say, wait a minute, I don't want to be a part of this, and walk off.
Exactly.
So they're highly dependent on the general population to build the prison. Mm-hmm. And that's why they try not to go too fast, because they can't afford for a complete walk off. But if we can bring enough transparency, I've seen tremendous number of people in the last 5 years walk off.
Absolutely. They need to lose their army of compliant, obedient, blind, and deaf people. So because we're telling them, and eventually everybody has to wake up. Eventually everybody has to take a stand.
Or die.
I mean, I
have to tell you, the hardest thing I ever had to do in my life was look in the mirror and say, I'm the patsy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had to face the fact that I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, and I hadn't begun to, you know, I was discovering the fraud, but I hadn't begun to face it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I don't know why that was so hard, but I've seen that for many people. And I've seen people who would much rather die than look in the mirror and say, I'm the patsy.
Absolutely.
So I think there's some people, that's why I try to help people who want the help. I don't try and help people who don't want the help, because some would rather die than face it.
Yes. It's unfortunate, you know. I don't go, you know, forcing my opinions on others. I just put my information out. People can come and take it and share it. But yeah, I've seen the change. Clearly the change in the society. Well, I think Meryl Nass just published the Kaiser Permanente had mask mandate for 4 days.
That is fantastic.
It's fabulous. It's fabulous. Yeah. Kaiser is as evil as it gets, as powerful as it gets. And all it took for a few more people to be aware of what's going on. And their mask mandate lasted all of 4 days.
Wow.
So.
Well, did you hear what happened to the Skidmore survey?
No.
So Mark Skidmore published a survey showing, you know, that in fact, the incident of adverse events and deaths, according to the random sample, was much higher than reported. And then he repackaged it, you know, did a lot of work and published it in February of 20, I guess it was February of this year. Within a week, it went to the number one viewed study on that journal's website, because Jordan Peterson tweeted it out and then some famous people retweeted it, and off it was running. And then it was retracted, of course, because it was now. What happened was his university was forced by this brouhaha to investigate him, the survey, everything else. And then very quietly, a couple weeks after they started, very quietly, they canceled their vaccine mandate.
Oh.
Very quietly. And I said, oh, it's because now their attorneys told them any attorney suing for an adverse event or death caused by your mandate can prove in a court of law that you knew.
Oh, yeah, it's discoverable. Now it's discoverable.
Yeah. And so you got to cancel this mandate because now you can't say you didn't know. You knew.
Exactly.
And you're liable. Right. Right.
Yeah. So that's what it means. That's just putting the proper, truthful information in the public space, which is all of this, all of us talking to each other and talking on media, exchanging messages. And yeah, let's turn their weapons on them. They have the spying weapon on us, spying right. all of our communication. Well, let's use it to communicate to them that right. we know.
Right, absolutely. So one of the things we need to do is it's certainly not the only mechanism, but the WHO mechanisms will give the asset and real estate steal, in my opinion, enormous power and mm-hmm. flexibility that you, if the bankers tried to do this without a healthcare excuse or a healthcare apparatus, they couldn't get away with it. You know, the crowd would turn on them too soon, but health is confusing and, you know, you have all these invisible enemies. So one of the things, anything we can do to persuade at the state and federal level for our legislators to say, you know, the WHO has no jurisdiction here. And then, you know, to the extent we create a national office, you know, to the extent the states can say, no, these powers are reserved under the Constitution of the state, you can't do it. So we've got to have as much as possible legal and legislative protection of this against this game before it starts. Now, Tennessee passed a law saying essentially no municipality could do anything based on the UN or any of its organizations that would compromise the Tennessee state constitution. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, can that hold an emergency and, you know, all the things the national office will assert, you know, hard to say, but you know, if we could get the next president to exit the WHO or Congress to force an exit from the WHO or just defund the WHO, mm-hmm. you know, we need to do it because, you know, this is like them coming for our guns. And this is, you know, they are coming for the real estate, in my opinion. This is going to be an asset grab.
Oh, yeah. The real estate, the earth, that's the, you know, finite real estate. They're after it. And that's how they're trying to do it.
Well, one question I often get, which is a very good question, is, well, what's so different now? Why now all of a sudden? Mm-hmm. And you have to understand, we have bubbled the paper, you know, whether it's the bonds or the derivatives and more paper and more, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Margin Call, but they do a wonderful job of describing, you know, it's like keeping the balloons up in the air or the plates up in the air. You just more and more and more. And if you look at the amount of paper that's outstanding and the call on real assets, you've got far more real assets collateral, you know, you don't have that many real assets. You yeah. promised 10 times your real assets and that paper can't all, you know, the commitments can't be kept. Uh-huh. So the question now is, now that you have 100 times the real assets in paper, the real game is going and getting the real, you know, who's going to control the real assets when the music stops? And that's why these guys are driving to control the real assets.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Because yeah, they want complete control before the paper, you know, before the balloons pop.
The balloon is popping very, very rapidly, even though it doesn't look that way, but, you know, to normal people just now.
Right.
But yes, it's collapsing. And then it's going to be musical chairs and you'll see a lot of these billionaires, well, they're levered to the hilt. I personally know several. Right. That are, you know, they are thought of as billionaires, but in reality, they own nothing.
Right. So,
and that's
right.
what
and they have to do what they're told.
Yeah, they have to do what they're told. Exactly.
They have to do what they're told. Yeah. So when I was an investment advisor, it was very interesting because I would have very wealthy people and then I would have people of modest means. But the people of modest means were desperately needed by tons of clients or people, you know, they were right in the thick of it and they were always needed, you know, so So right in the middle, not at the lower end, but say you have a very successful cardiologist, you know, his the demand for his services is just going up, you know, that it's because this is an environment that breaks your heart in a variety of ways. So he, people just need him. And he feels remarkably confident because he's needed.
Yeah.
It's not about money. People need him and he needs them. And there's a balance between them needing. Whereas if you just have money, you're totally dependent on the system and you don't feel needed. You don't get that confidence you have if you feel needed.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So get to know your neighbors. And if you don't like your neighbors, get to a place where you do like your neighbors.
That's true. That's true. It's absolutely true.